Hello, everybody. Welcome to the elections panel for SEJ Sacramento. Good morning, everyone. So I'm Dean Scott. I'm a senior climate reporter for Bloomberg BNA out of Washington. I spend each year since about 2005 covering the climate summits under the UN toward a climate deal that was reached in Paris in December. And some of the people up here, I even were familiar faces in some of those. I think I've seen Jim Connaughton might have been one of the first people I saw at the climate meeting in Montreal, which was, I think, 2005. That's how long ago that was. So I'm going to introduce our panel members. We're going to talk a little bit about the presidential election, where the candidates stand on the climate and a little environment. And I'll give a brief outline here at the beginning of some of what they've said, what we know, and talk a little bit about mostly the Senate races, about a minute or two on those, because it seems like the ground is constantly shifting on who's going to control the Senate and a moment on the House. I'm going to only ask one or two questions at most of the panel members, because I really want you guys to get involved. Stand up when you're throw your hand up. Stand up. I'll call on you, and then I'll probably repeat your question just because we're running audio and we want to make sure we get the question thrown back into the audio before the panel members answer. So our speakers today, to my right, to my direct right, is Heather Zeichel. She's Senior Fellow Global Energy Center Atlantic Council. She used to work at the White House under President Obama as Deputy Assistant to the President for Energy and Climate Change. To her right, we have Jim Connaughton. Jim used to represent the U.S. at the UN climate summits under the Bush administration. He also served to coordinate environmental policy at the White House Council on Environmental Quality. And then to his right, last but not least, is Bob Perciasepe. Bob used to be a long time at the EPA and also was acting head for a time. He's now at C2ES, a group that we all talk to in Washington on climate and energy. So I'll take you briefly through a couple thoughts, my thoughts on the election, and then we'll get right to me asking one or two questions, and we'll open it up. So first, I thought I would go a little bit backwards and talk about Congress. During much of the year I spend in Washington, in the Capitol, in a couple of the different press galleries covering congressional action on climate and energy. And so we watch, obviously, who's controlling the Senate very closely. It sort of determines the agenda, whether Democrats are on the offense and defense. And I'll just take you through a couple of the races for those of you who are sort of wondering where we are in terms of the margins in the Senate. So right now, in order to get for the Democrats to take the Senate back, they'll need a net gain of four if Hillary Clinton is elected president, because then her vice president would determine who basically controls the Senate. Or five the Democrats would need if Donald Trump wins. Where I think we are is very close to a 50-50 split. I don't think it's very unusual in history for us to come down that way, but I think we could easily see a Democratic majority of 51-49, and there's a slight chance here. I don't think it seemed very unlikely earlier in the year, but I'm not 100% certain that the Democrats take the Senate back, and that is all going to depend on coattails. If Donald Trump wins in November, I think you can safely assume Democrats will not. A couple races that I'm watching closely in Washington are Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana. We think all three of those are pretty much safely in the hands of Democrats. The problem there is that gives Democrats 49. They need to find a couple seats from toss-up states, including Pennsylvania and New Hampshire. So I think it's going to be a very interesting race. I saw some figures today that kind of, to me, explained where we are and how difficult it is really to gauge where the presidential candidates are in this race. Another poll was out, a good solid poll showing Hillary Clinton back up close to 5 or 6%. The problem is she's down by almost that same amount in Ohio, and usually that polls don't usually work that way for swing states. So it sort of tells you that the unpredictability of what we're seeing going into November. So I'll talk a moment about where these two candidates stand on climate change and environment. It's probably been the most interesting campaign I have seen in 24 years of reporting, in that I haven't seen one, particularly on the Republican side, so sort of devoid of deep policy papers on energy and climate, and which presents special challenges for the reporters in this room or people who are covering this election from, you know, this prism of energy and climate, because we're spending a lot of time, frankly, reporting Donald Trump's positions based on tweets, based on comments, based on off-the-cuff moments. And I think it's very hard to gauge how that translates into, for example, you can assume that his comments about climate change being a hoax, a concept that was created by and for the Chinese, was the tweet back in 2012 in order to make the U.S. manufacturing base non-competitive. You can find those in his statements on television and certainly on Twitter. The problem is we're not really sure what that means if he was president. Does that mean he's going to pursue an agenda as if this entire problem does not exist? That to us is an amazing, or would be an amazing 180 from any of the previous Republican candidates. You might recall George W. Bush went into that race in 2000 supporting a price on carbon. Later, there was a big shift away from Kyoto. But I think, as Jim would tell you, the Bush administration got kind of a bad rap about its position on climate science. You can find plenty of papers on big interagency government reports that don't question the very existence of global warming or the human contribution to it. And both of the last two candidates, Senator McCain and Romney, both had a record of supporting action on climate change, basically cap and trade, either legislation in McCain's case or a state participation in the REGI program for Romney. So that's a big change. I don't like when I hear from readers or at panels and people talk about how this is more of the same for Republicans. It would be a pretty significant change, actually, for the Republican Party, for someone who believes this problem is a hoax to be elected president. For the two big things that I'll talk about before I go into questions is the Paris Agreement. What is the impact of all this on the Paris Agreement? Didn't we just have a climate deal in December? And can the next president basically eviscerate that agreement? And my take on that is I spend a lot of time taking deep dives into what the UN is doing when I'm there at the summits, and we're certainly looking at the process for withdrawal if a president decided that's the way he wanted to go, in this case, Donald Trump. And I think probably the best take that I've seen on this, sort of combining a couple people have done some reporting and also papers, is it's very difficult, without boring you, about the hurdles that a president would have to go through under this UN system to explicitly withdraw, formally withdraw this country from what President Obama did in December. That's not really the hurdle. The hurdle is we're a long way away from the U.S. Quote-unquote withdrawal from Kyoto. That was a long time ago. The U.S. has built up a lot of goodwill internationally for what is widely seen as leadership, along with China, on getting the Paris deal. It would be a complete probably devastation of some of our more delicate international relationships with other countries if all of a sudden the U.S. decided it was all a little bit of a mistake and we're not going to do anything that we said we would do under Paris. That said, a president has lots of authority, and I'm going to ask Jim to talk about this and maybe Heather in a moment about, you know, President Obama provided a great template for what a president can do on an issue with or without congressional action when it comes to climate change. And we shall see if Trump is elected of what exactly how much of that executive authority he'll be able to use to reverse it. There are so many, I'll call them hurdles, procedural impediments to a president just saying, you know, I'm EPA, what you're doing on power plant carbon limits, I'm going to pull that back. It's just not that simple to do. So on the regulatory side, it's not an easy path, I think, for a candidate opposed to the president's agenda to do that. But there's plenty that they can do to delay, underfund, sort of create mischief. So I think in this area, when people are writing or you're interested in doing a story yourself about what happens to the Paris deal if this election is really close and people are really talking about it, is to assume that it's probably not the end of the world and it probably doesn't mean the end of the Paris Agreement. And it's also probably not that simple for the U.S. to simply decide that it never happened. And Hillary Clinton, I'll finish there before questions and say, Hillary Clinton, I think we watch her position papers and her speeches on energy and climate. I haven't found them to be incredibly detailed, but there are some numbers out there that I don't see a lot of other reporting other than sort of the inside Washington climate energy freaks that we are, like Kate Shepard and I see out there. But she does have a number that I think is interesting, and I'm going to ask Bob Perciceppi about this in a moment, is she has a number that a target of 30% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2025, and that's it's pretty ambitious in my estimation, simply because it goes beyond even what President Obama has proposed put on the table before Paris, and that was a pretty optimistic pledge in the sense of even what Bob's group, C2ES, has said could be accomplished, just the number that Obama had. So we'll be, if Hillary Clinton is elected president, we'll be doing a lot of stories about how she's going to squeeze out 30% when Obama's number is somewhere between 26 and 28. I'll invite you to look at an interesting thing that I haven't done much reporting on, but I think we'll see more of this the day after the election from Energy and Climate Reporters, is there's an interesting little addendum to Hillary Clinton's section on her campaign site about her $60 billion clean energy challenge. I invite you to look at that because it's very interesting. It's a ton of money. As anybody that follows sort of approps in Washington knows, you know, EPA's budget is somewhere around $8, $9, $10 billion a year. Finding Congress, getting Congress to appropriate $60 billion for a new program is a big lift. But there's some interesting things in there about rewarding local communities, states that go beyond certain figures that were put out under the EPA Clean Power Plan, for example. So it's sort of an interesting take on do better than what the feds say, you know, provide evidence that you're cutting emissions and you'll be rewarded with a carrot. Which addresses some of this concern that Obama has carried around the stick a bit too much on his climate agenda. So I'll start with a question for Heather, just because you're to my right, and we're going to have to share a mic, so this will be an easy handoff. Heather, I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about, frame this in the sense of what Obama has done in terms of taking a lot of action using his executive authority, whether it's the Paris Agreement or these regulatory approaches to climate. Is there any concern there at this point that he has provided some expectation that a president can take this action on his own, and so in a sense may have provided a framework for a Republican president who would like to use that same level of authority to maybe roll back some of these things?
Great. Well, thank you for the question, and thank you for the opportunity to join you today. I think your question is spot on. If you think about the arc of President Obama's time in office, we started out very much in a position of wanting to work with Congress. We were working back in the day, and many of you were reporting on the Waxman-Markey legislation in 2009. And, you know, that was very much a focal point for the president. It was very much a focal point of, you know, the cabinet in terms of engaging with the Hill, in terms of trying to think about how we build political space and create support among Democrats and Republicans for action. And remember, it was in 2008 that the Republican platform actually acknowledged that climate science was real and that economy-wide solutions should be thought of in terms of the response. Having worked on the last three presidential races and having sweat the details of way too many policy papers in my career, it is very telling to me that, you know, this race does not adhere to any standards, not only because of what we're seeing from the reaction of the American people, but just in terms of the actual substance of the debate. I mean, you've got a president calling, you know, climate change a Chinese hoax, saying, you know, just recently, in light of what's happened in Louisiana, in light of all the deaths that have occurred in my home state of Iowa, you know, that extreme weather events don't hurt people and won't cause death. So you've got a president who's pretty disconnected from reality and facts, and every other day I feel like he's rather than Secretary Chu, and when in office in 2009, had what I think is a pretty important saying. He said, people are entitled to their own opinions, but they're not entitled to their own facts. And, you know, as I apply that sentiment to this race, I think it's pretty fascinating. And I want to say, in light of the misinformation, the fact that this candidate is playing so fast and loose with the facts, I want to thank you for the important work you're doing to try and help people cut through and understand what really is at stake in this presidential race. Because on the issue that I've dedicated my career to, climate policy and environmental policy, I don't think that we've ever faced a bigger threat in terms of what we would see in a change of policy with the Trump administration. So, you know, going back to the question at hand, does the fact that the president has spent so much energy pursuing his climate agenda through regulatory tools jeopardize future progress? And it's the right question for all of us to be asking, right? But I guess I'd answer that question by saying it wasn't for lack of trying. President Obama, you know, started out of the box. We tried to move cap and trade. It would, you know, did not move in the Senate. There were a variety of different factors that, if you want to talk about, we certainly can. But, you know, I think the long and short of it was Congress wasn't acting, and even when, you know, we tried a middle-of-the-road approach through a clean energy standard, which I know something you had advocated and supported and traditionally had Republican support, you know, we got zero receptivity from the Hill. So if you wanted to make progress, it became very clear by the time the president was in the second term, we were done engaging with Congress. And, you know, that's when we had a tough talk. I remember talking specifically to the president and saying, look, you know, we have to put a plan out there that's comprehensive in nature, that allows people to understand what we're going to do. Otherwise, you're going to spend your second term announcing energy efficiency standards and the Clean Power Plan and a grant program for climate preparedness in our communities and all these things. They're not going to add up to anything real. So, and that's when we put out the Comprehensive Climate Action Plan that sort of provided a roadmap for all the regulatory actions that the administration wanted to take. And I thought it was, you know, I'd love to hear Bob's perspective on this, but one of the things I thought was particularly helpful was my takeaway from that experience was putting something out there that, you know, the American people could read, understand, but also hold the administration accountable was incredibly important. And the fact that we were able to do a presidential memorandum with specific dates in mind for both getting the proposal out, but for getting the final rule out, really forced, you know, the administration as a whole to work together to adhere to these deadlines, which is kind of a nerdy, uninteresting part of how the government works. But at the end of the day, it was very important to creating the kind of momentum that I think the president needed as he headed into Paris. And that was certainly something we had in mind as we were working with about 13 different agencies to develop this comprehensive plan. You know, while I think, tremendous. Nobody's going to deny that probably historic progress was made on the climate agenda under Obama's time. Because they were regulatory actions, they certainly can be unwound by a future Republican president. But, you know, I also think that there are some policies that you're going to find an interesting reaction from industry. Let's take the fuel economy standards, for example. Heavy-duty trucks, you're not, I mean, the trucking industry came to the White House and said, look, we want to be regulated. We currently didn't, you know, in 2010, there weren't fuel economy standards in existence. So they wanted regulatory certainty and predictability. So I think that's an example of, you know, you've got some in industry that have that actually acknowledge that regulatory certainty is actually a helpful thing. So rather than me sitting here saying like everything's just going to be blown up, I think that it would be harder for a Republican administration to blow up all these incremental pieces, especially when you have some support from specific industries. I'd also say, I mean, notwithstanding, you know, all the important reporting you're going to do on the Clean Power Plan next week with the DC circuit, you know, that you've got a lot of people in the utility sector that are saying, hey, you know, we're actually not all that thrilled about the fact that we now are back in the courtroom with a Republican president. We have no idea where we would land on all of these issues. And we're in the middle of trying to rethink our entire business model. So we'd rather like rip off the Band-Aid and do this all at once, as opposed to try and figure out our business model. How do we integrate all these new technologies? How do we deal with DG and, you know, more renewables on the grid, et cetera? And then, you know, 5 years down the road, be slapped with a carbon tax or some other economy-wide policy. So it's not, while on its face, I think you look at Trump and you're like, wow, that's completely, like, it's hard to imagine him embracing any climate policy whatsoever. I think it'll be harder to pull these pieces apart than, like, as you start to think about each individual policy, I think it's harder to sort out the right, you know, where this lands. And in any instance, you're still going to be, you know, MAS versus EPA isn't going away for the Clean Air Act. So you're still going to have compliance. And yes, you can throw up a bunch of legal blocks and delay action, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I guess I feel like we have to be careful about the assumption that there's just a switch that can be turned on and off. You know, I guess the last piece that I will say is, in as you think about the regulatory environment under a Clinton administration and what that means, one of the luxuries, I guess, of being one of the first, you know, being a first mover in this area is that the president had this huge platform where we could go to the Defense Department, we could go to HUD, we could work with EPA and Interior and really think, you know, let's do a blue sky exercise about what we could really do on the regulatory side. But so much has been done. I really think that's what makes it more difficult for a Clinton administration to really identify, like, these are the four or five things that are really going to light up the world and really excite the environmental movement in this country, because so many of those tools have been deployed. So I think, you know, how they bring in some of these policies that aren't going to make it across the finish line from the Obama White House, like the PEIS for Powder River Basin coal or the midterm review for light duty vehicles in 2017, those are going to be important, but she's going to have a challenge to identify, you know, what are the new things that, you know, can really excite the base and can frankly help us meet the aggressive and deep emissions reduction commitments that we have in Paris, because she's embraced those. She will continue to embrace those. And you know, and if you assume you're going to focus on a regulatory agenda because Congress is definitely not moving any time before 2018 on anything comprehensive in nature on the Hill, you know, you're going to have to do some creative thinking with your agencies early on.
Thanks, Heather. Jim, I wanted to ask you on this topic of sort of Republicans and and moderate sort of takes on energy and climate to tell us a little bit about this Clearview group. A lot of us that were writing about this in Washington sort of peripherally, at least, and a little bit about what they're aiming to do in terms of being a voice in some of this energy and climate debate. And also, it's a conversation we had a little bit yesterday on the sidelines, and it's something that is not really being addressed under the climate deal internationally right now that is interesting. So the Bush administration worked on a lot of these sectoral sort of approaches during and on the sidelines of the negotiations or toward a climate deal or whatever, what Obama basically brought to be a climate deal. And Jim has some pretty, I think, interesting things to say about the sector-by-sector sort of approach and what the Paris Agreement may not actually address outside of actually looking across country to country to country and looking at finding some ways for example, the cement industry or the steel industry, et cetera, to have sort of common carbon reduction goals. So if you could talk about that, that would be great.
Thank you. Great to be in front of this group. Let's see that again. Can you hear me okay? It's on. All right. Good to be in front of this group. I've had the privilege of doing this several times, many times over the last 15 years, and engaging with a lot of you individually. I like this format in particular because what we're really here to do is help guide your thinking on how to write your stories. Take my comments in that spirit. First, I just want to start. There's a very big energy and environment agenda that faces both presidents. We tend to only focus on climate change these days, but there's a lot of interrelated activity. So don't lose sight of the fact that there's a pretty massive agenda administratively, internationally, and then legislatively for whoever's coming into office. You also have three people who've had the rare privilege of working through transitions. And the transition is a very, very interesting animal. So I don't want to go deep into that with all of you today, but I think any of us would be more than happy to help you understand what actually happens inside the transition process, because there's a lot of misunderstanding about that. So let me just start with that at the high end. I'll get to ClearPath in one moment. Let me just give you one other set of reflections. It would be really helpful if you went back and looked at George Bush's 2002 Climate Change and Clean Energy Plan and the much maligned Dick Cheney, Energy Policy Plan back in April of 2001. And then just did a rack-up of the Energy Bill of 2005 and the Energy Bill of 2007, both massively bipartisan, with a Republican-led Congress and then a Democrat-led Congress, which actually was the legislative foundation for a lot of the important work that President Obama and Heather and the team did. And then in particular, go to a speech that George W. Bush gave in April of 2008. It's called the Right Way, Wrong Way speech on how to address climate change and clean energy. I just want to say all that because then Heather referenced the Obama source documents. And then to go to Dean's point, and I challenge you, take a look. There's 90% alignment through that arc from what the presidents are saying and doing, not the Congress and not just what the arc of policy, largely administrative policy, but with some very important legislative policy, the consistency of that arc domestically, but also the consistency of the very heroic efforts it takes to get a deal internationally, and then look at just the G8 communiques of the last 12 years. With W. Bush and with President Obama. So just take a look at all of that as your foundation for then what to see in either a Clinton presidency or a Trump presidency. So I think that's just great homework, really level set you. It's really interesting stuff to read. So I want to start high level there. The ClearPath Foundation, of which I'm proud to be a part, was founded by a North Carolina businessman who just did very well for himself and for his family, and he really wanted to zero in on conservative clean energy solutions, something that I'm about, conservative clean energy solutions. And if you look at the arc that I described, when you get to the core of it, the debate is how far, how fast, and at what relative cost over different periods of time. That's really where the heart of the debate has been, if you sort through all the political noise, and just differences of opinion about that, and differences of opinion about methods of accomplishing goals. And it's come together in a set of mandates. There's 100 mandates now, either directly or indirectly controlling for carbon at the federal and state level now, 100. Very different from where we all started in 2001. There's $150 billion of federal and state incentives swashing through the system, very different from where we started back in 2001. And so I actually am quite optimistic about what's coming, because what's coming, you now have a big lump of clay, a lot of policy coming out of the Obama administration, a lot of commitments coming internationally. There's actually a big lump of clay to work with, and so don't miss the point that there's this huge debate, just how can we do it faster, smarter, and cheaper. That's really where the debate is, with a lot of noise at the two fringes. But the heart of the debate is now faster, smarter, cheaper. And why do we know that's what it's going to be? It's exactly what happened on clean air back in the 80s and in the 90s, something some of us lived through quite intensively. And we're about to go through the same process that we had a lot. We finally ramped up nationally to this incredibly Byzantine mix of policies around clean air. And really the 90s and into the early 2000s was an effort to try to rationalize that. And that's where I see incredible opportunity for common ground. We had common ground on the 2007 energy bill, the biggest mandates in history in the world on transportation and on fuels and on efficiency and on lights. So you can get to yes on those kinds of things. But, it's hard to get there. So that's a top line point. Now, specifically with respect to the presidential, let me add one point to Heather. If you want to find something very instructive about the incentive program that Dean mentioned, Jennifer Granholm gave basically a preview of the whole thing in rich detail at a Stanford conference called Setting the Climate Agenda. It was a very well-crafted, very intriguing, and compelling presentation. I have significant issues with it. Not with its intentions, but with its design and its construction. But that's worthy of a good old-fashioned policy debate. So, but if you want to learn about it, it's in much more detail than you'll get out of the policy papers right now. And she's putting a lot of thinking into it. So I don't know that it's specifically campaign policy, but it's a really useful way to get a feel. And then at the end of that conference, John Podesta gave a very good sort of additional meta perspective of what the Clinton folks are about. Trump's a little bit more difficult to decipher. I thought I would share with you, though, I want to cut to the core of Trump, which is this quote. Let me get it here so I can get it exactly right. Okay, but this is the quote you have to look at. Because remember, Mr. Trump is very transactional. Mr. Trump has spent his entire career hedging his bets. And I think if you really want to look at the tea leaves or the divining rod or whatever your choice of shamanism might be. Here's the quote. I believe in clean air. Immaculate air. But I don't believe in climate change. Okay, so I think that really sums it up. And so it just raises all kinds of wonderful questions for me, having worked on clean air and immaculate air issues and then on climate change issues. There's a lot to work with inside of that statement. I do think on the differential point, Trump will, and he's been very clear, be very aggressive about further ramping up U.S. energy development of all stripes. And so I think I'll be very interested to see what a President Clinton sort of, because she knows this stuff inside out, and she's not opposed fracking. She's got lots of issues about how to do that well, from what I can tell. So I don't see a real slowdown in the natural gas piece of the equation, but the North American energy piece of the equation, the commitment to all sources of energy. I mean, I think there's going to be some really interesting puts and takes between those two folks. But I do generally agree a lot of what's in the system is very well established in the system. It's very, very hard to stop the pathway of what's occurring. But it should be common ground. And let me just throw out some real quick things. On the domestic front, if you add up individual mandates, and I did the math about 3 years ago, so I'm going to be wrong, but it'll just give you a size of the bread box. You know, we're doing wind at $400. I'm sorry, solar at $400 a ton right now. So the RPS plus the incentives. We're doing wind at $200 a ton. Corn ethanol is getting is basically $200 a ton worth of carbon abatement. Corn ethanol is $100 a ton. $200. And cellulosic ethanol, which is more greenhouse gas reducing, is only $100 a ton. The cash for clunkers program was $44,000 a ton. So if you look at any of these individual policies that we've had to come forward with for the lack of a federal legislative simplified solution, every one of them is coming. You know, Waxman-Markey, the huge fight was that you might break $20 a ton. Right? That was a huge. That's what cratered the whole discussion. It might get to $20 a ton, and yet every one of the individual policies passed by Democrats, by Republicans at the federal level or at the state level, right? Every one of them is coming at a substantially greater cost per carbon abatement than anything that was debated in Washington. So there's just a lot of space to work with there. Internationally, I'll end with this. Internationally, it was good to finally have Paris over and have a general sense of direction, but the real work is still ahead. There's hard work ahead. It was a non-binding agreement, and so it was within the president's prerogative. It was basically further implementation of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which the Senate did ratify. And because it's non-binding, it didn't create new sort of legal entangled commitments that might be trade enforceable. The legal argument is then, therefore, it's sustainable as a presidential agreement. Now, my preference is that this thing be put in front of the Senate, and let's finally have the debate, how far, how fast. It would be nice to just reconcile that. And by the way, if the how far, how fast comes up a little bit short of the Paris commitments, from my perspective, I'm okay with that too, as long as it's down and it's long-term. Because you can design a lot of policy around down and long-term, like we did on the acid rate trading program. You know, and we're now at, you know, on our way to 90% reductions from coal-fired power plants with a program that started at 50% reduction. So you don't have to get it all right away. But from a legitimacy perspective, the Senate should do its job. That's sort of my perspective. And we should call on the Congress to keep saying this is the legislative prerogative, and this, well, okay, make it one. They didn't, and so President Obama did what he did within their interpretation of their authorities. I have some tweaks there. But in front of us is you still have to get to the brass tacks of sector-by-sector actions. That's the way these international programs work. There is no economy-wide or global-wide implementation that's going to come out of Paris. It's just raw, rolling up the sleeves and going sector by sector, major economy by major economy, figuring out how far, how fast for each of those nations based on the commitments they made in Paris. There has to be an effort to have a common measurement verification system, which the Chinese and the Indians in particular have been resisting for 20 years, and they still are resisting it. And until we have a common system that's credible, reliable, of measuring and verifying emissions, we do not have a credible international climate regime. And then finally, we have not addressed the issue, the very important issue, and you all need to be focusing on this, access to energy for the poor combined with leakage. So the two issues that are the crux of political debate and divide domestically and internationally is access to energy for the poor, which I think is going to be an issue of the globe for the next 3 to 5 years, and leakage. Now, leakage is this. Certainly we can all agree, Democrats and Republicans and unaffiliated, that a domestic U.S. policy that simply shifts investment to a place overseas that has 2 or 3 times the greenhouse gas intensity that we have is not the kind of outcome we want. So we don't want to cut our emissions by 1 billion tons here and see them go up by 2 billion tons someplace else. And that, no one's focusing on this. Democrats or Republicans, no one's focusing on this. It's the crux of the challenge we face. And I will give you the fact around that. So when I left my job in 2008, projected emissions in the developing countries, it was projected 40 gigatons of emissions. So to meet the Paris goals, for example, you'd have to cut that down to 20 gigatons. Well, just 8 years later, that number is 60 gigatons. So there's a 20 gigaton increase in emissions as a result of China, India, and a few others, that we now have to abate back down to 20 gigatons. Okay, the problem globally has doubled, and it's not the developed countries. Developed countries' emissions are flat and declining. Okay, so every new steel mill that's built in China that's not built in America is a 3x increase in greenhouse gases. All right, that'll be one example. report on this. This is very important if your objective is global greenhouse gas emission reduction and clean and healthy air, and you know, and countries not killing their populations, you know, with just good old-fashioned dirty air. Put the two together, because that also is a good indication of real intent, especially by China. I love their commitments on greenhouse gases, but if I go to China all the time, and it's not getting any better when it comes to good old-fashioned air pollution. And so if China's not tackling the air pollution that actually kills their people, then how can we look at their commitments with respect to CO2, which currently does not? Ask those questions, report on that, and don't let anyone off the hook, both domestically or internationally, on that essential point.
I want to give Bob I have one quick question for Bob, but can you raise your hand if you have a question coming so I can kind of gauge where we are in time? I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I like to pretend there's one over here. Somebody help me out here. There we have one. So, Bob, I'm going to try to – I'll ask you to be as succinct as you can on my question, and then I'm sure I'll redirect some questions your way as well. What about the? I brought up this 30% target. I think if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency, that'll get a little more attention from environment reporters such as in this room. And I wonder. So your group is among those that sort of had some skepticism in terms of Obama's existing target, in terms of saying, you know, there's only so much that can be squeezed from states and the existing Obama policy. So when his administration put this 26% to 28% cut by 2025 on the table, so what do you say to those that say, well, you know, now we're just really picking numbers out of thin air to say, if you can do up to 28%, I'm going to say I can do up to 30. Where's she going to get that cut?
I think it'll be 40.
That's a succinct answer from Bob P., ladies and gentlemen.
I'm just kidding you. You know, it's just, it's for me, it's getting late in the day. But all right. So let me just say a couple of quick points about that. First of all, the analysis that C2ES did, and by the way, we are a nonpartisan organization. We don't have any particular political bent at all, but we are, and we have a bipartisan board, and we work with businesses, but we all that believe that something should be done about climate change. So in this current world, that does sometimes make you appear to be partisan, but we're not. And so we did an analysis of all the different reports and activities that are out there, policies that are in place. And while we could not show that the existing policies by themselves would get you to 26 to 28%, we fell about 4% short of that. We did identify a number of other things that could be done in the next 9 years to make that happen. And 9 years is an interesting number because I actually went back my, and I'll mention some of those in a second, but I went back and looked at, this is just purely the projection stuff we were talking about yesterday, Jim, but in 2005, the Energy Information Agency, which is the gold standard of thinking of energy data in the federal government, and we can all quibble about that, but that's basically they keep the books on all the data, their projection to 2014 was an increase in greenhouse gases of about 10%. What really happened was a decrease in about 10%. I'm rounding here. It might have been 11.2 or 9.8, but so essentially they were 20% off in 9 years. Now we're talking about 9 years in the future, right? So I mean that's one thing I could say. I rest my case. We don't really know, but the issue really is what happened in that 9 years was the, for lack of a better word, the real. Coming to fruition of the technology of directional drilling and hydraulic fracturing and the stabilizing of the supply and the price for natural gas, coupled with an aged a fleet of coal-fired power plants where utilities just finally started to make the decision what to do with them. Now, sometimes they enjoy complaining that it was EPA that made them do it. Sometimes they enjoy complaining about somebody else. But the bottom line is a convergence of things, including it was time to invest in them, and they decided not to. And they decided to invest in the new shiny object, which is a much more flexible machine called a combined cycle gas generator, which is essentially a big jet engine. And so we see virtually no new coal plants being built in the United States, and a decline in the number of them that are actually running, whereas I think in the last 12 months, the amount of electricity generated by natural gas in the United States has now exceeded the amount generated by coal, which actually makes a more diverse portfolio. If people complain that we're losing our diversity of fuels. No, we're not. We're actually increasing our diversity of fuels. The other thing that happened was the cost of renewables and the cost, particularly wind and solar, has continued to go down. And part of that has been driven by research and other public policies like production tax credits and investment tax credits, which you may have noticed the Congress actually extended for 5 years for wind. And it actually turns out to be, I think, 7 years for solar because they already had two years left on their existing one. That was not even taken into account, when EPA did its clean power plan, what the effect of that production tax credit and the investment tax credit will do. So one of the things we identified in our analysis, without analyzing what its impact would be, because we didn't have the amount of time and energy to do that, is the work that's being done at the EPA report that we were looking at and analyzing and the other reports were all based on what the federal policies were. But if you notice, states are doing a lot of things, businesses are doing a lot of things, and cities are doing a lot of things. None of these calculations are able to take into account that, we're pushing closer to 100 companies now. Major companies in the United States have agreed to go 100% renewable. That's going to we don't know what that's going to do in the demand system. So there are many things that are going on that I don't believe that are currently being counted, and there could be some other transformation that would happen. I know this sounds very weak. There could be, but if you really want to look at where the big hitters are, and it's A, that there are other things going on other than federal policy, and that's actually starting to accelerate. B, the price of natural gas is not going to go up in the next decade. It's not. And so that trend could actually accelerate. They're just a very reliable machine in a much more distributed kind of power environment. You know for yourself, if you fly an airplane, that jet engines go on and off a lot more quickly than firing up a boiler and boiling water, which we used to do in the 1880s. So I think that short-term climate forcers like methane and HFCs, which are now, we are hoping that something will happen at the Montreal Conference of Parties. I believe that the business community is working harder, and EPA is doing some regulations in this area, but I think the whole thing, momentum, is to tightening up the natural gas system so that there's fewer leaks there. There are some issues related to land use that could come into play. Going back to the big hitters of transportation and power, there's more that could be done there in the next 9 years that I don't think we're thinking about. And we're on the threshold, and when I talk to the executives in the power industry, the CEOs, their heads are in, we're in a transformative moment for electricity in the United States in terms of consumer choice, in terms of how they run their business, as being more of a provider of a platform of activities, sort of like your cable or your telecom. So that transformation could go faster, but there's certainly room there to do more. I mean, we could say EPA could do more sectors under the 111D. And I think that in the 2017 reevaluation that I think Heather brought up for the automobiles, there's no technological bar to automobiles doing better than 54 miles per gallon on average by 2025. the question is how might that roll out and whether they can maintain the consensus with the industry. So those are just a couple of quick points on the gap. And, you know, if you take an objective look on this, and certainly what we're working on as a next step to that survey report that I think you were referring to, is what's the range of things that are possible under all those different things that could be coming into the game that are not currently being seen?
Great. Thank you. Thanks, Bob. See some hands for questions, and I see Cheryl in the very back. Are you the only one back there that has a question in the last six rows? So I'm going to economize on time, I'm going to get all three questions, ask them loudly to me, I'm going to write them down, I'm going to repeat them so that the tape can carry them. So identify yourself. If you're a reporter, we prefer that you kind of go first in this initial round. Go ahead. Okay, so just to reiterate, we have a question on the coal industry and particularly looking at job loss through the prism of job loss in Colorado, and if there's some other ways to look at that as a theme for stories going forward. In the Feingold race, reporters looking at that race closely wants to know if there's some other ways to look at covering environmental issues, particularly in the Senate. And then we have Cheryl talking about sort of raising this question is do we just have a slight differences on climate change and energy between Democrats and Republicans, or is that actually a much wider gulf, particularly given Tea Party sway in the Republican majority in the House? The first question, I'm going to take a volunteer on the coal industry and job loss, and it's going to go to Bob P.
I'll start. It's an industry in transformation. I think I've mentioned I may have mentioned this yesterday, but I teach a class and I actually have these two photographs of the Easter parade in New York, and you think, what's that got to do with coal? Well, one of the pictures is in 1900 and it shows the parade all with horse-drawn carts or carriages. 13 years later, 1913, the same shot, same Fifth Avenue, there's no horses, it's all cars. 13 years. What happened to those horse carriage manufacturers? Obviously, transformation is something that happens in American businesses all the time. We have, and I think appropriately so in some respects, glamorized the coal worker because of the fact that we built the country on the backs of their digging that stuff out of the ground and giving us the energy we needed in the last century to build what we have. But it is in transformation, and I think the rhetoric is making it hard to find sensible solutions to those Americans. You know, some of the sensible solutions are obviously economic development funds in some of the coal country, dealing with the United Mine Workers pension fund so that those families are taken care of for the work that they did for the country, and retraining and finding jobs in other sectors, and even building new sectors and new ideas for that in some of the coal country. This is what we should be spending our time talking about, what those solutions are, as opposed to having a fantasy that somehow the coal industry can come back. It's like saying we need to get back to building those carriages that are drawn by horses because, damn it, those were a lot of people. They did a lot of good for the United States with the Pony Express and everything else. We, you know, in the Wells Fargo wagons that used to go across the country, why can't we bring them back? You know, and, of course, we don't say those things. So I think the rhetoric should stop and the solution discussion should start. So those who have asked, is the rhetoric hurting solving the real problems of real people? The answer is yes.
Let me comment on coal, then quickly on the other ones. Coal's been an important part of our mix. It's a national security resource. It's here. We have it. And we need to be aware of that. What's interesting is you went from a period of this big boom in coal. Remember, it was when the nuclear stopped and when gas prices went through the roof that coal became king again. Right, so coal got a big windfall from market forces. okay, combined with sensible clean air policy. Now, we went through the same thing in the 2000s that the Obama administration went through in this last decade, is we tried to get legislation that would have created a rational system for investment in clean energy, including clean coal, and Congress wouldn't come to an accommodation. We had to do it regulatorily, had to go through all the lawsuits that we're now experiencing on carbon. But let me just give you the anecdote. President Obama proposed a clean energy standard in the State of the Union in 2011. Okay. His goal was 80% clean energy, okay, which meant in his proposals there's 20% reserved for fossil, including coal. You have a legislative compromise on that. Let's call it 70%, because that's what happens. It would be a 30% outcome, okay, which would have provided 25 years of certainty as to how much of the fleet could at least be reserved for coal in its current form and created a growth industry for technologies that could abate carbon from coal. Okay, but for lack of legislative certainty, okay, which would have been President Obama's plan, would have reserved a place for coal. Capital planners, I used to be a senior utility executive, city planners, and co-ops, because of the uncertainty, you can't make a big capital decision related to coal, because you don't know whether it's going to be taken away from you regulatorily through other forces. Now, by the way, coal still has to compete head-to-head with natural gas and other sources, so it's still got to compete. And the bigger driver, as Bob said, for coal has now been natural gas. It hasn't been the EPA. It's been natural gas. But by the way, there's still a great and important place for coal, in my view, if you get the policy right. And we can still keep on track for our emissions. On the Senate, the New York Times today, as of 5 hours ago, Republicans have a 59% chance of winning the Senate. That's up. That number's going up in part because of some key races. Portman's now way up. Kelly Ayotte is some questions that were in doubt are solidifying. And by the way, they're solidifying in split states. It's places where Hillary Clinton is up, but the Republicans also up. So the split ticket scenario is a really interesting one to me. I don't know from Democrat or Republican-led Senate. With respect to this set of issues, President Obama had 60 votes in the Senate. Couldn't get cap and trade done, couldn't get a clean energy standard done, didn't elevate EPA to cabinet elevation. There are a whole bunch of environmental things that didn't happen when President Obama had 60 votes in the Senate. When I look at the times things do happen, you had George Bush and Nancy Pelosi with the biggest market-based mandates in the history of the world in 2007. So I don't think it's as easy as splitting outcomes on partisan lines, because at the end of the day, these energy and environmental issues actually split on regional lines, not on partisan lines. The noise comes from the fringes, but I'll also say the fringe point. Notwithstanding the Tea Party with one set of excesses or the climate alarmists with another set of excesses, the House has not halted any of the major Obama initiatives. So there's not enough weight of political impact in the House to produce a legislative outcome in conjunction with the Senate to accomplish a reversal of these things either. So, you know, the system's working the way it's supposed to. And all voices have a legitimate part of the debate. The question is, who's got the more persuasive majority?
I just want to add to that last statement that there's a president that would have vetoed it. If there is a president that won't veto it, it'll be a different story.
But my point is it hasn't even gotten to his desk to veto. That's my point.
Okay, so just a few additional points. I mean, starting with the question about the Senate and sort of what might be the agenda, I think if you assume a Clinton administration, one of the early pushes where I think you will see her try and engage Congress is on an infrastructure package. And, you know, on its face, a lot of people think about bridges and they think about roads, but they don't necessarily think about the new opportunities that we have around, you know, green energy technologies, microgrids, DG. How do we actually get a toehold in an infrastructure package on these issues? CAP is coming out with a big report in the not-too-distant future, and I think the NGOs are doing a lot of thinking because it's an interesting opportunity and one I'd like to see the environmental community and, you know, sort of green voices take advantage of. After infrastructure, it becomes harder for me to envision exactly, a very detailed set of opportunities. On the flip side, if you are dealing specifically you know, with a Republican Senate and House, I think you, in, you know, looking at some of the chairmen of the specific committees, you're going to continue to see some of the witch hunts about, you know, what happened in, you know, the EPA administrator's Twitter account, or did she talk to somebody on her personal cell phone, or, you know, who did they talk to at the Sierra Club to finalize this regulation on methane emissions? So, you know, I think that's, we kind of know what they have, you know, they've kind of proven what their game plan is, and I expect more, unfortunately, expect more of the same there. But I also think, you know, as you are thinking about the transition and thinking about and writing about who might be in the next administration, you know, confirmation could be a walk in the park, or it could be a hellacious, drawn-out, multi-year or multi-month painful process, or multi-year, depending on how, I guess I haven't had enough caffeine this morning to be on the brighter side of things. But so again, those are just a couple of pointers. And, you know, I think on the coal piece, one of the interesting policies, which again gets back to, you know, just the extreme difference between Trump and Clinton on these issues. You see Clinton out there with a very thoughtful policy about, you know, how you make this transition, what kind of resources can you provide coal communities, and then you have Donald Trump just making blanket statements about how, irrespective of any economic rules or common sense, he's going to put all the coal workers back to work. So, you know, I think the great work that you all have done to shine a spotlight on the fact that it's not an EPA like regulatory broad brush that's been painted that's actually the problem here. This is cheap natural gas, more affordable renewable technologies, better battery technology, etc., that's really driving this transition. And on the last piece, I guess I would love to believe that you can boil down the debate on climate change in this country, at least inside the Beltway, to how far, how fast, and at what cost. But I don't even want to imagine what a debate in the Senate would look like on ratifying Paris, because it's almost as depressing as contemplating a Trump administration. But I think the question in my mind is, how far and how fast can we get back to a dialogue with Republicans, knowing that climate change is real, that there are bipartisan opportunities to work together? We saw it with Tosco reform. We saw it in the Republican and Democratic support for a multi-year extension of the wind production tax credit and the investment tax credit for solar. And that's really where I think we need to drive the conversation.
And before I go to the left-hand side, I would just say in passing, because we had a question on Colorado, is I think it's not always the only important game in town in D.C., I think, in covering the House and Senate. It's not always the margins. It's the people and the policies that they bring to bear. And I've looked at a couple of these races. Some of these names are familiar of people who are running this year, particularly in the two rematches, including Bayh and Feingold. Both of those guys voted for the 08 climate bill that was on the floor that Boxer and Lieberman and Warner tried to get, and it didn't get very far past the procedural vote. But my point is, you have two people coming back to the Senate that have, who are most likely coming back to the Senate, who already have a record on this issue. They're replacing two people, so that's you're netting a gain, certainly, but you're also taking out of the Senate voices who are extremely dubious about the connection of climate change to what we're doing in the world. And then you have McGinty in Pennsylvania, who like Jim, used to head the Council on Environmental Quality, but during the Clinton administration. So I may point that out is, you know, it's not just whether you're a Democrat or whether you're in the Senate or a Republican, but whether you sort of see that there's a need to begin to take action. It's going to take years in the Senate for any kind of significant climate bill, but you're going to need those kinds of voices to begin to sort of build up a good number that the Republicans sort of see it as at least a serious effort at that point. I'll take a couple questions on the left, and take a look at your watches. I know they want to get all of you to the luncheon, and I think some people might have some flights, et cetera. So we're going to try to do this I have 6 minutes of, so we're going to do the six-minute warning. I'm going to go from rear. Lightning round. Pencil raised. Go. I know Jim's going to be biting to answer that. He loves this question, and I'm going to go forward and take both of you in a row back behind you first. No, you? Yes. Okay, so we have a question on how much support could Trump get on a deregulatory agenda that's fairly expansive in terms of rolling back regulations, oil and gas. We have a question about the attention paid to Clinton's focus and running essentially to I guess, let's see if I have that right, to Trump's right or left now on TPP, because she's basically expressed concerns with the agreement she previously supported. We have a question about the role of terrorism and sort of national security and its impact on climate change and the focus on the American people on that issue. And a great question about India's per capita emissions and some of Jim's comments on the developing countries' rising emissions. Shouldn't we be taking into account the fact that these developing countries such as India have a much lower per capita, carbon footprint? Jim, you want to go first, and then we'll try to keep everybody to like under a minute so we can try to just rattle through as many of these as we can.
On India, very important issue. My number one personal priority is energy for people to lift them out of poverty. That's my. I don't care what kind of energy it is. Cheapest, most affordable they can get as soon as they can get it. More people out of poverty are more people that are better educated. Wealthier societies can afford the pollution controls that we all want. So however this works out, I'm completely on board with your point and support it. Two, we have to lead then in getting the cost of those technologies down and making them available. There's common ground action in the United States for work on natural gas fracking and natural gas and transportation as an alternative to coal. There's a clean coal agenda that can be pursued. Hydropower is a huge opportunity, especially small-scale hydropower. Nuclear energy is still an approvable, usable technology in nations that can responsibly use it, and India is certainly one of those. So the fact that we are – I think it's pathetic how slow we're moving on that, and there's a lot to be done. And then – but the rich-poor divide in India and China, the energy users – per capita emissions is the way I want to look at it, not the total population. And in China in particular, the energy users' emissions per unit of GDP or per capita is right there alongside or higher than America's. There's a lot of people who don't have energy that get averaged into the mix, and I don't think that's fair or right. I certainly think that I just want to be sure that on this other point, there's lots of social and moral and equity issues, and I'm so on board with all those concerns. But to sharpen the future, we need to keep our eye on the ball. Just keep it simple, stupid. Focus this particular set of activities on getting aggressive, reasonably defined, and economically sustainable carbon abatement. And the political process will continue to sort out the balance of equities through all the mechanisms that we're all very good at. When you put them all into one policy and try to carry it all on one policy, that's why we don't get some of these outcomes.
Other last word.
So just quickly on the question about national security and extreme weather, I mean, one of the challenges associated with, at least on the extreme weather piece of this, has been attribution, right? We want to talk about it, but we also don't want to, you know, run afoul of not being scientifically accurate when we report on these issues. I think a lot of really important work continues to be done that's going to help us improve our ability to do that. But it's also incredibly frustrating as somebody who's been trying to think about how to communicate on these issues, how to advance a policy, how to advance a politics, that you know, you watch flooding in Louisiana, you turn on the TV and you hear about Zika in Florida, and nobody's talking about the climate aspects of those issues as well. So I think we all together have a responsibility to continue to work on that issue. And just quickly, on the Trump support in Congress and the deregulatory agenda, I mean, let me be clear. I am very concerned about what a Trump administration would do on the environmental agenda, and I don't take that lightly. So I, you know, if I left an impression that we don't need to be worried, that's certainly not something. I mean, I think we should all be awake at night worried about. he's made it very clear he's going to work to unravel a lot of the success of President Obama and a lot of the success to clean up the air, the water, and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. You know, in terms of what does he confront in Congress, I mean, today in the Senate, you have about 40 solid pro-environment voters. And you have to really think about how far that's going to get you if you're trying to flip the equation where you currently have the Republicans saying, you know, let's take away the Section 111 Clean Air Act authority of the EPA. Let's, stop the methane regulations for new sources. Let's stop the EPA's ability to think about methane regulations for existing sources. And I think it would be a real challenge that this president's going to have to be, if it is, you know, in a Clinton administration, she's going to have to be very comfortable using the veto threat. And she's going to have to be very cautious about counting votes because, you know, those margins, as we've talked about, are not going to be providing us a lot of comfort.
My apologies to Bob, but we're getting the hook only because they really want everybody in there for lunch at noon. Parting shot to say to all of you, we have a joke around where I work in D.C. with my environment, energy, climate team. We always like to come in on Monday and tell each other that we really appreciate the good work that you're doing. It sort of stands in for a great quote of support or comment of support from management. So I want to say to all of you, I see some faces here that aren't necessarily environment energy reporters, but I know you all follow this issue, and I know all of you work very hard in it, and we're in an always transitional industry. And as somebody that's been doing this for 24 years or something soon, you should go home from Sacramento from this conference feeling pretty good about the work that you do. There's some other things that you'd be doing in the world right now, and this is important. I'll leave you with a quote that I heard from Bob Dylan recently. Every couple of years, I decide to spend a lot of time listening to Bob Dylan. I recommend it to all of you. He says, a lot of things can get in the way when you're trying to do what's right. So have a great lunch, and we'll see you next year in Pittsburgh.